Welcome to The Dish, the culinary travel podcast focusing on the stories behind world-famous foods.
We are your hosts, Tomo and Megsy from foodfuntravel.com. Join us for tasty histories, destination food guides, and more.
In the second part of our tapas feature triple episode, the history of four of the most famous and historic tapas dishes. They are
gazpacho soup, albondigas, which is Spanish meatballs, patatas bravas, chunky potatoes with spicy sauce, and croquetas, Spanish croquettes.
All right, this is part two of the Tapas podcast. We've got three episodes on tapas coming.
Yes, we've left you salivating for two whole weeks, wondering about what are the top tapas dishes we're going to talk about in this episode.
Unless you literally just rolled straight from the previous episode, Netflix style, into this because you're actually listening years after it was released.
That's
who knows?
True, yeah.
That could be happening too. But if you have been waiting 2 weeks, hopefully it'll be worth the wait because we're talking about four really popular, like, these are big name tapas dishes. These are not weird, obscure things. These are ones like...
It's the you gotta try. Yeah. Yeah.
Universal tapas dishes that you'll find in a lot of different bars all around Spain and probably all around the world these days as well. If you missed the last episode, we were talking about the origin stories of tapas as a style. So there's eight different theories on that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were a little bit misty and not convincing at all.
No, but if you haven't listened to the first episode, please pause right now, head back, listen to the first episode so you kind of have a bit of an idea of what we're going on about. You'll just have a little bit more of a background information into tapas and then come right on back here to this episode and keep on going.
Yeah, I totally recommend listening to the episode first too, but if you don't want to, it's all right because these are all independent little stories. Four independent little stories of four different tapas dishes, but just give you a bit more context on what's going on with the whole history of tapas in general if you go back and listen to that first. All right, let's jump into this with one of the most famous. I think this is probably, if you go to Spain and you go to any tapas bar, unless it's like a really fancy tapas bar that doesn't do generic tapas at all, this is going to be on the menu. It's patatas bravas.
Yeah. And I think even before I'd been to Spain, it was like the one that I had heard of is patatas bravas.
Definitely one of Spain's most common tapas or tapa dishes. It's chunky fried potatoes served with a spicy sauce.
Can't go wrong with that.
And the variation on the size of potatoes, the cut of the potatoes, the style of the sauce, it's just impossible to measure.
No, everyone does it a little bit differently, but fried potatoes with sauce.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? But nothing.
Rather than just being chunky potato, I think it's really the sauce that makes it a dish, because otherwise it's just fries, right? But the sauce is like, now it's patatas bravas, it's a dish.
Yeah. I personally like mine with a little bit of extra spice going on. I can find myself very disappointed if it's a little lackluster in the spice category.
Yeah, it has caught the eyes of everybody and the taste buds of everyone around Spain. Bravas means brave, referring to the bravery needed to eat that spicy sauce, apparently.
Really? That's spicy.
Well, possibly. There is actually another theory that we'll discuss, but that's one reason why it might be called bravas. We literally had everything from like a thick tomato-based sauce that's, you know, just spiced with chili to sort of something that's a bit more like a spicy mayo. Like, we've had so many different types of sauces. There's no consistency. We've had it served on French fries, wedges, cubed fried potatoes, pretty much any type of fried potato. We've had every different version you can imagine.
Yeah. When I think of like an actual patatas bravas though, it's the square cubed potato with, well, actually I think of it with the spicy mayo.
Ah, interesting, because that is probably not the original brava sauce.
No, probably not.
No, the tomato-based one is much closer to the original, I think, from the story that I've got here. But yeah, for a dish that's this humble, like it's just potato with a spicy sauce, you're like, is there even an origin story for this, or did it just start happening? Well, interestingly, if you only go into the very most basic research and look at Wikipedia in English, it's a complete dead end. They're just like, nah. No history.
Yeah.
It's potatoes with spicy sauce. There's some vague message about the origin story being unknown. No one knows the origin story. And as so often happens whenever we do research, if we actually take a look at articles written in the local language rather than in English, we come up with some other alleyways to walk down and find some interesting information. So Spanish Wikipedia was my next port of call to see what they were saying. And there's this recipe book called El Practicion from 1893, written by Angel Muro. The reference from this book suggests that patatas bravas is the potatoes of the poor and includes fried potato with a spicy sauce. However, I actually tried to get the original book because it is available for free on Google Books. And although there is a patatas a la pobre, which is potatoes of the poor, it's listed in the book, but the recipe has absolutely no mention of las bravas sauce or any sort of spicy sauce. It's just like fried potatoes. So like, all right, well, that's a bit of a dead end because I'm like, this is working. There's an actual recipe. It's on Google Books. This is going to be easy. Okay, so it was called patatas a la pobre before and then they changed the name later, but this is going to be potatoes with spicy sauce. No, it's not. And patatas bravas, not present in any search of that book, like searching through the index or contents or anything.
Ba-bom.
So I was like, oh, thanks Spanish Wikipedia. Incorrect information there as well.
Well, it is sourced by the people. Anybody can edit Wiki.
Information
of
the poor. For
all you kiddies listening out there right now, don't use Wiki for your, you know, your homework because anybody could write that.
Información a lo pobre. The information of the poor. That's
yes,
what I'd call it.
Exactly.
It's a good starting point, but yeah, I do find some of the time it's pretty inaccurate. So it was just really odd that there's a direct quote from this book on Wikipedia, but no actual reference to the exact page in the book where this recipe is. So, and this is all I could find after looking through this, is that that recipe, potatoes of the poor, is there, but no.
No,
it's not
bravas. Correlation
no spicy
between the
sauce.
Two. Yeah.
Nah, doesn't seem to fit. The next claim I found, which is not from Wikipedia, I had to dig a little deeper and find like a local news report sort of website on this one. The claim is that patatas bravas comes from a restaurant in Madrid called Las Bravas. So it's not referring necessarily to the braveness of eating the sauce.
It's a restaurant called
The
Brave. It's an
actual restaurant and it's their sauce. So supposedly this restaurant was established in 1933. Originally, it was a wine tavern, which eventually got converted into a tapas bar after the Spanish Civil War finished in 1939. And the bar changed at some time between 1939 and 1950s to become more of a tapas bar. So yeah, sometime after the Civil War finished, they were like, all right, we're doing tapas now. So it's not clear that the bar was always called Las Bravas. I can't find that. But, you know, having a bar called The Brave seems sort of that seems like a common name that people would come up with. That
yeah.
doesn't seem crazy. That's not far-fetched at all. So not sure at the exact time that it changed, but definitely by the 1950s, they began to serve chunky potatoes with a house sauce, which was their Las Bravas sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you might be like, this story seems a little bit too good to be true, perhaps. Is this one of those restaurants like, of course we invented it? Because we find a lot of those stories where we're like, oh, yes, of course we invented it. Because our name of our bar is the same as the sauce. So of course we invented it. But the crazy thing about this story is they actually patented the sauce in the early 1960s. They own the trademark Las Bravas sauce. So, yeah, when you go on the website, it's like Las Bravas, rights reserved. You can buy the sauce in jars. They've patented this as a sauce. Somehow they didn't manage to patent Brave Potatoes because, well, maybe people had started using the name before they patented it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they went, we need to patent this, but it's too late. So many other people are using the name already.
And I'm guessing you need some sort of evidence of, well, I mean, it's their sauce. So, of course, they've patented that.
Well, they have the patent, apparently. I haven't seen the original patent. I can't go that far with this because we didn't know about this when we were in Madrid, so we didn't go to the restaurant to find out.
I know, I'm quite bummed
They
about
opened
that.
Another restaurant after that as well, so they're still popular, they're still opening, they're still selling patatas bravas. But yeah, apparently they actually have the registered trademark. And as they're using that on their website everywhere, it's in their history, they are having the rights reserved thing next to it. Apparently they definitely own it.
right.
So I guess no one else can sell jarred sauce called Las Bravas. Maybe they have to just call it something else.
Yeah.
I don't really understand what the copyright information is here, but they seem very clear. So unless they are 100% making that all up, which of course is possible, it seems like, yeah, the sauce has nothing to do with the fact that it's spicy. The name came from the bar that was already called The Brave.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, sort of interesting. But their sauce definitely seems to be more of a tomato-based, like, bright orange sort of sauce.
Yeah.
It's not a mayo, spicy mayo type of thing. But, yeah, aside from it being a good dish, I think it's also a little serendipitous that because it was called The Brave sauce and it was spicy, that probably helped it in terms of marketing it around the country and it becoming, like, a popular national sort of dish.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so that really helped. And yeah, no other sort of written references that I could find before the 1960s. So if other people were making patatas bravas and this bar just went, oh, they've got this name and it's the same as our bar, we should paint that. I mean, that could have happened as well.
Yeah, it could have happened.
But yeah, just no one else went and got it written down. And as we've seen in so many episodes, if you don't get it written down, then everyone's going to think that the place who wrote it down first is the place that invented it.
Because what is it? Was it in the taco episode that we did that there's like an artist in Mexico who patented the fish taco? And she didn't make it, but she just went and patented it. Like, because
I don't remember that at all, but no, I don't know.
Oh, it was something like that. But yeah, there's a chick in Mexico that like owns like, whether it be like, it's either the fish taco or the burrito or something like that. And she just went and went, I want to patent this. And they went, all right.
Yeah. Sneaky.
Yeah.
So who knows? Yeah, they might have done that as well. Maybe they changed the name of the bar when they patented the sauce because they realized how popular the dish had already become very rapidly.
Yep.
I don't know. We don't know. And yeah, that's patatas bravas. So those spicy little potatoes.
And we should say, if you haven't tried them, very tasty.
Everything in this episode is hopefully tasty stuff. All right. From one food of the poor. Originally, at least, apparently as a food of the poor, but then turned into a spicy, wonderful sauce. Potato tapas. Another food of the poor, croquetas, or
yes.
The Spanish croquettes.
I was so surprised that this was such a big dish when we were there.
It's the perfect little snack, isn't it?
It is.
So simple.
It really is.
So easy to make and cheap to make. That's what you want. It's a beer snack, wine snack, isn't it? It's a perfect little thing on the side.
Yep.
So, yeah. Croquettes, in case you weren't aware already, are deep fried breaded ball or cylinder of, well, essentially leftovers or cheap ingredients. They might not always be made with leftovers. Some people make fancier ones freshly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just using up those leftover bits and pieces. And they are often flavored up with something of a slightly higher price, like Serrano ham, chicken, cod, mushrooms, or prawns, and often held together with bechamel sauce or sometimes a brown sauce. Well, bechamel seems to be the most common, and potato is sometimes the base ingredient to sort of make it thick. But we've also had ones where you bite into it, it literally like just falls apart and oozes bechamel sauce, like cheesy, eggy sauce. And you're like, this is much better than just potato.
That was a really good one, yeah.
I do love them. So they also do exist. Both of these types exist. You'd need to check with a waiter before you order. I guess the potato-based one is slightly more common. And
it's easy. It's pub food, isn't
it? Yeah, it stays together really easy, whereas the one that's saucier, I guess it's quite easy for that to fall apart in the fryer or leak or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, apparently bechamel is like an essential ingredient for a standard croquette. So even if the bechamel is mixed with a little bit of potato to thicken it up, that is like one of the original ingredients. Mm. That's sort of the way it's supposed to be done. Now, all right, so history with this. A little confusing. Definitely some surprises going on, considering it's just it's a croquette, which seems so simple.
Yeah.
Again, simple dish. A little bit confusing. So officially, according to like almost every source that I read, croquettes were invented or at least formalized and finally made like, this is croquettes, this is the dish, by Auguste Escoffier in 1898. He is actually known as one of the kings of modern French cuisine. Escoffier is said to have modernized traditional French haute cuisine. So he was a big deal.
Mm.
He was the guy who went, right, this is what we've done before, and this is how the future of French food is going to go, back in sort of like the late 19th century. And he was executive chef at various really internationally historic venues, such as the Ritz in Paris, the Savoy in London as well. He was credited with inventing dishes like peach melba. So, like, he actually invented that, apparently. So the croquette seems to be In my opinion, it's more of a reinvention that he did, because there's lots of other dishes that seem to have existed before 1898 that are very similar to a croquette.
Oh, yeah. One would think it'd have to be around for way before that.
Possibly in Jewish cuisine, at least since the 17th century. So, like, once potatoes were here, then, you know, they mashed it up and they deep fried it with some breading on it. Like, this was already apparently going on.
It's not rocket science to put that meal together.
And yet, for some reason, everyone credits Escoffier in 1898 as being the person who invented it. Like, people use the word invented. And
is
like,
it because he did it with, like, stuffing, with stuff inside? Or is it the bechamel, the incorporation of the bechamel?
I really don't know, because no one went into that much depth. They're just like, well, it's in his cookbook. It's called croquette.
That's good enough for
French.
Me.
Yeah.
Wiki.
Croquettes. I mean, it is French. It's a French word.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, he took something that already existed, changed it a little bit perhaps, and called it croquettes. Maybe he's the one that called it croquettes, but I'm still not even sure about that, because I have some other references as well that sort of conflict with this.
Like, does croquettes mean something?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can look that up quickly.
What's the difference between croquettes and croquet?
Croquet. Some article actually wrote about croquet. Be like, this has got nothing to do with the English sport. And it's like, but the bottom of the hammer, a croquet hammer, is the same shape, like the cylindrical shape of a standard croquette.
That's what I was
so
thinking.
So someone actually said this as a theory.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's no evidence.
It's a stretch.
Yeah.
It's quite a stretch. But I was like, oh, well.
All right. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with croquet. The etymology croquette from the French word croquer, which means to crunch. There's something crunchy.
There you go.
I thought that sort of made sense, like a crunchy thing. So there we go. That's the etymology of it. So it's quite a, yeah, it's a crunchy little cylinder of potatoey stuff, bechamel-y stuff, and other bits mixed in.
If you
in.
Don't get crunch, then they're doing it wrong.
But the weird thing is, there's also some claims saying that because potatoes come from South America, that even when the Spanish first arrived in South America, that they were deep frying potatoes.
Oh, as I said, it's not
in their sort of like mashed potato crispy sort of, I mean, they wouldn't have had bechamel sauce.
No.
They probably weren't breadcrumbing it, but they were making little cylinders of potato and deep frying it.
Potatoes, not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a new thing.
Apparently, but that's an unsubstantiated claim that I haven't found any definite evidence for. As for written records, though, here's something that really confuses me and throws all of this other evidence really out the window.
It was brought here by the aliens.
The aliens were part of the story, of course.
I reckon if everyone actually does storm Area 51, like they keep talking about, they're just going to find like a massive surplus of, just be croquettes.
Just
everywhere.
Frozen croquettes in bags.
Uh-huh.
That's it. Could be that. Written records, though. This one not written by aliens. This is the Steward's Handbook and Guide to Party Catering, published in 1889, is a cooking manual written in the USA. And it states, specifically using the word croquettes, that the word signifies something crisp. Croquettes are balls or any shape of almost any edible thing, floured or breadcrumbed on the outside and fried in plenty of hot fat, then drained on paper.
Mm-hmm.
That's the exact quote from that book.
That's exactly what they are too.
That's exactly what they are. And that's 9 years before Escoffier's recipe was set as being like the inventor of croquettes. So not only is that exactly what they are, but that is the exact word that the French use to name them.
Yeah.
And it's already in a written book 9 years before his thing. So I'm like, why is every, and I'm not just saying Wikipedia, like almost every story I read, they've all read Wikipedia and repeated the same story.
Interesting.
I don't know. This just seems so weird. All right. So that seems pretty crazy, 9 years before, right? And I found another reference. This is the Goody's Lady's Book of Receipts and Household Hints. Sounds classic here.
That sounds like a good read.
That does sound like a good read. This is from 1870, and it details a recipe and method for potato croquettes that is almost identical to the modern recipe from Escoffier.
With
same
the bechamel
word.
And everything?
I don't have the actual recipe. I have a second source saying that this exact recipe is in there. And
all
the
right.
other one also a secondary source, which is a direct quote from the book. It's possible that they made up the quote, but I just find it really weird to actually have a quotation mark quote of like, this is the exact words they said, and this is the exact book and reference.
Yeah.
I couldn't get the original book. So I'm more inclined to believe it when they've used original quotes. Sure, it could still be made up, but you know, if it had just been, oh, sure, this book has something about this, like some of the other stories have been, But this one, they're very specific about the quote. So at least the one in 1889 that has the direct quote, 1870 also claims to have a recipe for this. Now, this next one, even more reliable, I hope. Menus from the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York clearly detail croquettes as being available at some point between 1859 and 1865.
Is this even a Spanish dish at all? No, we said it was French.
No, it's French. Apparently French. But now it's like, well, the name is definitely French. But whoever originally invented croquettes has been lost from any sort of historical record because the actual menus list croquettes on a menu in New York sometime around 1859 to 1865. Apparently there are copies of these menus, but they're not sure what the dates were.
Mm.
That's the theory. So I'm like, really? This is almost 40 years before Escoffier apparently invented the croquettes?
Yeah.
So I'm just really confused as to why everyone thinks he invented them. All I can think is that he recodified their preparation to a new style.
Yeah, he did something different.
Something to do with the bechamel sauce, maybe.
Rip, pivot, and jam with the old croquettes.
The other ones are like breaded potato deep fried. Maybe he was the one who first added ham to them and bechamel.
Yeah.
I really don't know, but the word's the same and the dish is very similar to what we eat today as croquettes, potato croquettes. But maybe that's the difference. Maybe the Spanish and French version is different from the American version and all these references are from the US for books and restaurants in the US. And maybe in the US they were already making a very basic potato thing and then Escoffier made this much more complicated bechamel crazy version. I don't know. But the potato croquette's obviously like one of the most famous types all around the world. But in Spain, it almost always has something else in it. It's always got ham in it. It's always
I've never had just a plain croquette in Spain.
Seem to do that. So maybe this is where the stories diverge and potato croquettes went off to America and then Escoffier fixed everything and made European ones more interesting. I don't know. But at least in Spain, yeah, you're going to find much more interesting versions of croquettes. I think I like Spanish croquettes. They are some of the best
style. I like
style.
It with- Something, something.
Croquetas, yeah, a little bit of gooey sauce, a little bit of serrano ham mixed in. It really makes these things pop. And although every restaurant has their own take on a classic Spanish croquetas, be ready just in case you're not sure what you're getting because you might be sprayed all over your t-shirt with bechamel sauce.
It's always fun.
Yeah, that could happen. But you're also going to be lucky because those are tastier than the potato ones. So, you know, good luck with that. All right, we've got two more dishes. I'm just going to mention briefly that tortilla de patatas, the Spanish omelette, of course, one of the most famous dishes in Spain, in the world, from Spain, probably. We did actually already talk about this in depth in our What to Eat in Madrid episode, season 2, episode 26. So if you want to hear about that, because that was quite a crazy story. I did a lot of research in the end. It was like a full rabbit hole with that one of trying to figure out what was going on. It's good to go back and listen to that as well if you want to hear about that, because today, we're talking about a couple more tapas dishes that are not Spanish omelette. So, let's talk about a tapas dish that comes from Andalusia, which is Seville, is one of the main cities in Andalusia that people know. Cordoba, I believe, is the capital, historic capital of Andalusia. Down in the south of Spain, it's really hot down there. So, one of their favorite sort of tapas dishes is a gazpacho soup. A cold tomato soup.
I like a nice gazpacho every now and then.
Yeah, it's good, especially when it's hot. They also have another one called salmorejo, which is a very specific sub-variant of gazpacho, although some people claim it was invented independently. We'll look at that as we go through. And it's very similar. It's also a sort of tomato-based soup.
Something about salt with salmorejo?
No, I don't know, actually. I didn't look at the etymology for that one either.
Oh, all right.
But red gazpacho is the most common gazpacho. That's the one that's made with tomato and a few other vegetables like cucumbers and bell peppers are thrown in. And it's actually thickened with breadcrumbs. I never even realized this, but that's apparently that is the traditional way. I'm not saying that everyone around the world has followed that recipe, but they make it thick. They make it a thick soup rather than just a tomato, gooey tomato paste by using breadcrumbs to thicken it out. And that is like, if it doesn't have breadcrumbs in, that is not gazpacho soup. And we'll find out why as I go through the history of how it was invented.
Hidden carb attack.
Yeah. We're like, oh, a healthy option.
I'm choosing the healthy meal.
So yeah, of course, it's served cold because it's super hot down there during the summer. The most famous sort of cold Spanish soup was like the gazpacho. The red gazpacho was definitely not the original because tomatoes apparently only started being added to gazpacho in the 19th century. So that world famous red gazpacho soup that most people might have tried, the only one from the region that people probably have tried if they haven't been to the region, it actually would have been made with different ingredients and not with tomatoes at all. So it wouldn't have even been a red, probably. And there wouldn't have been bell peppers either for a while, because that's all Latin American food as well.
Very much so.
It appears the original soup was definitely made with breadcrumbs. That would have been the main ingredient. And it may actually have first been made as a typical food choice of the Roman legions as they spread their influence across Europe. They mixed old bread with garlic, salt, olive oil, and vinegar and mashed it into a paste. And presumably that was like the base for a soup that they could then make. Maybe they'd add some hot water that had been boiled so that it was safe to drink.
Yep.
And then they had their sort of bread soup sort of thing. And that was the original information. Of course, the Romans like to write stuff down. So apparently that is definitely true. It seems like a solid source. But the base ingredients of that original Roman soup are sort of what probably have made it into the modern gazpacho, which does normally have all of those things in. Legend has it that this base paste was actually even carried by Columbus on voyages, because I guess the olive oil and vinegar made it keep longer. It was salted as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have this bready paste, and then whenever they needed to eat it, they just add boiling water and it's ready to go. It's food. So apparently Columbus took that on some of his voyages to America. It was like a good stored bit of food. So this has been around for a long time. Probably wasn't called gazpacho at that point.
His own little taste of home.
Yes.
When little Columbus got a little bit homesick, he'd get out his tomato bread paste.
Didn't have any tomatoes.
1492,
1493, no tomatoes.
Go find, okay, so he just
vinegar
get out
bread
his
paste.
Vinegar bread paste. And he was like, just like mum makes it.
So, yeah, as I said, some modern variants seem to have less bread, but I don't think anyone who's a purist about gazpacho is going to tell you you've got to have bread in it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not gazpacho, it's just tomato soup. So, a similar style of soup making is said to have also arrived to the south of Spain during the occupation of the Moors, who came from North Africa and took over the region from around 711 AD. Their similar soup had the addition of almonds, which were ground into the paste.
Hmm.
So it was like a bready almond paste with olive oil. But given the date of their arrival and the fact that Rome had some influence over North Africa during the time of the Roman Empire, like a few hundred years before that, it's quite possible that the Moors had created this because the Romans brought that dish to North Africa.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay, we can grind this up and we can add olive oil because the Romans brought olives and grapes around the Roman Empire as well. I'm not sure if North Africa had grapes and olives. So I don't know. I don't know
for sure. They
definitely
do now.
They definitely very much do now. They make a lot of olive oil in Morocco. I don't know if they were making it back in Roman times or if the Romans brought it. Because apparently the Romans brought olives to Portugal and Spain. So they didn't have them until like 200 BC or whatever, apparently. So what they've got in Spain today, rather than gazpacho, they have another similar cold soup, which is called the ajo blanco soup. And this is from Malaga, so a little bit further along the coast. And this one seems like it's closer to the Moorish version of the soup, where they use crushed almonds, even today, same sort of preparation, lots of garlic and the other ingredients, and they turn that into a white soup, so there's no tomato added. They actually throw in things like melon and grapes into that to give it like a little sweet bites in between
Weird.
The garlic. So yeah, that's like a very interesting summery soup with fruit and garlic.
That's
sort of crazy.
Strange.
So that seems like a direct descendant of the North African version, and everything seems in some way connected with North Africa or the Romans bringing it in, and then Spain turned it into her own thing. So I mentioned at the start of this little segment as well, the salmorejo, which is from Cordoba in Andalusia, and unlike the red gazpacho, which is actually, that's the common one that you will find in Seville, and of course has become world famous from there, the salmorejo adds only tomatoes. They don't add any extra vegetables. So like a regular gazpacho, they're throwing in a few extra bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But this is just tomatoes with the base paste. And it's really thick. So they don't add water to it either. It is just like a sludge. And it's garnished sometimes with little cubes of boiled egg or with some Iberico ham. Totally unusual dish. We didn't get to Cordoba, so we didn't get to try this. Obviously,
no.
We've had gazpacho quite a few times.
I've had gazpacho, but I haven't had this type of gazpacho.
So if you're heading to Cordoba, do find this. It's like one of their most traditional soups. They're very much their most traditional soup. Really interesting sounding dish, but yeah, sort of like a tasty sludge.
Yeah.
Pretty thick. But I guess once you mash up those tomatoes, you can get it a little bit thinner. So maybe it's not too sludgy, but the photos do make it look a bit sludgy.
Yeah.
All right. Our next dish is probably one of my favorites. We're moving away from the world of potatoes and breadcrumbs into the world of meat. This is albondigas.
I do like some albondigas.
Yeah, it's Spanish meatballs served in a sauce or gravy. Sometimes tomato-based, sometimes sort of a brown sauce base. It does vary depending on what people want to make.
Where were we just recently when we had the amazing albondigas? And we were like, I'll have some more of that. Thank you very much. Was that in like Mallorca or something?
I don't remember. I do remember we were on a cruise ship and we had some really good albondigas in a little tapas place there, but not
Oh, we did, didn't we?
That was surprisingly good. It was like the only good thing in the tapas bar. Yeah. Their meatballs and the sauce was great.
We weren't on that cruise for the food.
No.
It was to see family.
Yeah. So, I don't know, but there's obviously lots of great albondigas around Spain. And, yeah, meatballs in sauce, come on, that's a great little snack on the side with your wine. Like red wine, glass of red wine and some meatballs.
Can't go wrong.
Brilliant. Tapas, awesome. So, not surprisingly, meatballs have evolved simultaneously and independently in many cultures quite early on. It's not really that complicated.
Are you not going to go into the history of the meatball right now?
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of history of the meatball as we go along. But yeah, it's, you know, you take the slightly less, at least originally, you take the slightly less choice cuts of meat and you chop them up really fine, which sort of, you know, if it's tough and old meat, it pulverizes it a bit, tenderizes it a bit. Then, you know, you're chopping through flavor by putting all these herbs and spices inside of it. It's basically a good way to use up extra bits of meat that are not the premium bits, right?
Yeah, although it's so delicious.
Yeah. I mean, today people might make meatballs from better quality meat, but honestly, like the dirty meat is probably the best meat to make meatballs with.
Yeah.
That's what you want. A little bit of fat, a little bit of something else. It's just all chunked up in there. Now, the oldest reference to making meatballs, this one is an unconfirmed reference. I couldn't find a definite original source on this, but the oldest meatballs might have been made in China in the Shandong region during the Qin Dynasty around 200 BC.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally all the information I have about that. I can't find any specific stuff, but I mean, it completely seems possible. Why not? They liked pork.
Yeah.
Meat in general, they're eating it. So
why not?
Chop stuff up, make it into a ball. Why not? A more definite reference that is absolutely 100% confirmed is from our old friend, the book Apicus, which has come up in a few episodes because it pretty much is the original Roman cookbook from the first century AD.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the oldest solidly referenced cookbook that like they have a copy of it. It still exists. It's still happening. It's a real cookbook. It's full of recipes. So if you want to hear a bit more about that, then go back to our lasagna episode, which I think was season 2, episode 1. Yeah, there's an actual recipe in Apicus for making meatballs. So have a guess. What meat do you think that ancient Romans would be preferring for their meatballs?
Horse.
No. Bit more weird.
The meat of their slain enemies.
Man meat.
Man meat.
That could be something else. That's something else. It's not that kind of show. Nah, something completely unexpected. It's from the bird kingdom. And it's not a bird that you'd think people eat, but apparently the Romans said this is the best. Well, Apicus cookbook said this is the best bird meat to use.
Is it dodo? Because like no. It was like so good, they ate them to extinction.
They hadn't found dodos until like James Cook turned up there in like the 16th, 17th century. It was the early 17th century. So no, there were no dodos in Europe at this point. A interesting, unusual bird that's a bit noisy that is not a rooster. Another noisy bird.
Cockatoo.
Nah, because isn't cockatoo from
Australia? Probably.
Yeah,
but
also,
you know.
James Cook. You don't know a lot of history about your own country, do you?
A noisy bird. There's a few of them.
Colourful. Or at least the men are.
A peacock.
Yeah, peacock. Peacock.
Peacock meat?
According to Apicus, the best meat to use to make meatballs in the first century AD is peacock.
That's the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Because I didn't realize that people even really ate peacock.
No.
Never seen it on a menu. Now I'm interested to try it as meatballs, just in general. So peacock is their number one choice. If you can't get a peacock, pheasant. also a good choice.
Yeah, pheasant makes sense.
Can't get a pheasant, then rabbit is popular.
Ooh.
And then after that, apparently chicken and pig. Which I was surprised, because I thought chickens were mainly used for eggs until more recently. I mean, I know they eat them a bit, but maybe it's like only rich people ate them.
Well, they'd already been snacking on the peacocks. They're like, let's give those guys a try.
Yeah, we'll try these little birds. Why not? So yeah, pigs right at the bottom. And beef's not even on the list.
What?
They're not eating beef meatballs at all. So, just like the gazpacho soup we were talking about before, the other big influence on southern Spanish cuisine, aside from the Romans, because of course the Romans must have had some influence on them making meatballs, perhaps. That information was passed on over the centuries. Once again, the Moors. The Moors are back, 711 AD. They also apparently brought their own meatball ideas. Once again, as I said, with the whole bread paste thing, it's like, well, if meatballs were already being made in Rome in the first century AD, maybe the Moors got the idea from them.
Yep.
I don't know. No one seems to know. But the name albondigas, etymologically speaking, is definitely connected to the Moorish dish and the Arabic term albandica, which may have also been pronounced albunduca. And it translates roughly as the ball you eat. So, a meatball. Well, no meat mentioned, but it's a ball that you eat.
Yep.
That definitely makes sense that they were naming it after that. So maybe they were making meatballs before, and then when they got taken over by the Moors, they had to change the name.
Why did they have to specify this? Like, what balls were people trying to eat that they shouldn't be eating?
Well, no, they're probably saying, like, well, this is a football, and this is a ball you eat. Like, you don't eat the football. Obviously, you don't eat a football. So which ball do you eat? Well, the ball you eat.
Why do they have to specify that this is the ball you eat? Like, what have people been snacking on?
I don't think that they were specifying that it's the ball you eat. I think they were just going, oh, what is this? Oh, I'm eating it. Oh, it's the ball that I eat rather than the ball that I kick around. Not that they didn't have football at that point, I don't think. But yeah, it's more of a like, what is an orange? It's orange. It's an orange.
Yeah, orange is an orange is an orange.
An orange is an orange, isn't it?
What came first? The orange or the colour?
Yeah, the orange or the orange. I don't know. We don't know. But anyway, it's the ball that you eat. This one actually has some written references going back. A 12th century Moorish scholar called Ibn Rasin al-Tulbi, almost certainly pronounced wrong, describes minced meat mixed with spices and egg whites and then cooked in salty water, which sounds almost exactly like a meatball.
Yep.
Even got the egg in there and everything. And later in the 13th century, the recipe had evolved to involve garlic, and sometimes was pan-fried rather than just boiled.
Nice.
And that's where it's already starting to evolve into more of the Spanish version, where they're adding garlic to things and such. Then it actually takes until the 17th century, at which point the Moors had totally left Spain, and it was back to being, well, it had become the Kingdom of Spain. In the 17th century, a recipe that resembles very closely today's sort of albondigas, where a guy who wrote a cookbook called Hernández de Mazares, he describes a recipe with mincemeat, beaten eggs, breadcrumbs inside, of course, that thickens up the meatball, chopped fat, so adding some extra fat in there to make it tasty, garlic, herbs, and spices. And he also apparently describes a few regional differences for different meatballs around the country. So he was making the effort of going like, well, this region does the meatballs a bit like this, this region does the meatballs a bit like this. And of course, now today, putting it in a bit of sauce is like the way to go.
Yeah.
Everyone loves it. Bit of tomato sauce, fantastic. Bit of brown sauce, still pretty good, but tomato sauce. Wine sauce.
Yeah.
That'll work, red wine sauce. So yeah, the humble meatball. There may be more to the story, but that was sort of the brief version of the meatball story. Maybe if we can find more evidence, we'll do a full history of meatball one day. But yeah, it first documented in ancient China, perhaps, but probably Rome. And it seems like the popular modern Spanish albondigas definitely owes its name and probably its current formation to the Moors being there and laying their pressure on and making that happen.
There you go.
So it's a little bit of a joint effort.
Yeah.
A little bit of a mix. A bit of fusion.
Co-parenting, co-feeding business going on there.
Exactly. All right. That's four of Spain's top tapas dishes. In the next episode, we're going to be moving on to something that's tapas, or is it? Because we're going to be talking about other styles of small plate dishes from around Spain, which are not necessarily Spanish. Because there are some parts of Spain where people are like, well, we are in Spain, but we don't consider ourselves to be Spanish.
Very much so.
So there's a few areas that want their independence, and they have their own version of small plate dishes. And we're going to be looking at the history of some of those. So we're looking at pinchos, which is from the Basque country.
I love pinchos.
We're going to be looking at montaditos, which is from Andalusia. And well, they're not trying to separate from what I'm aware. We were talking about Andalusia before in South Spain. But montaditos, another famous small plate dish. And we're going to be talking about some tapas that is famous in Catalonia, in the region where Barcelona is. And also Mallorca used to be part of Catalonia and the islands around Mallorca. So this is all like, they feel like they're different. They've got their own language. They've got a lot of different customs and history from Spain. And so is this stuff tapas, or is tapas the name for the Spanish stuff? And this is their version of tapas, but it's not tapas because it's pinchos.
They do call it something very different.
And other things. Yeah, they've got a different name for it. So we're going to be looking at the history of those different sort of offshoots. Were they inspired by tapas? Did they appear independently? Going to be having a little bit look at the history of that. But yeah, as for this episode, of course, this is part two. If you didn't listen to part one, go back and listen to that. If you want to listen to part three, it's coming in a couple of weeks, or maybe it's out already. And of course, rate and review.
Please. Yep, we love reading all of the reviews that you guys leave us. So please let us know what you think of this episode and other episodes that you've listened to. Because come on, let's be honest. If you're listening to this, you're going to just go back and binge them all. It's that thoroughly entertaining.
Do it. You'll learn a lot about food. 5 stars is the only amount of stars that's worth leaving. Anything other than that is going to break your computer. There's a virus in your computer that was implanted there by Apple. Now you can only leave 5 stars. Even if you have...
It's crazy.
Yeah, even if you have Microsoft stuff, they've also got the same virus. Every computer's infected. Only for our podcast. Other podcasts, do whatever you want. But our podcast, it's stuck on 5 stars now. So don't try and press any of the other ones, because you're going to get a warning sign come up and it's going to be like, your computer is infected. It's going to explode soon. Like, seriously, it's crazy. I don't know why this happened and why they did this, but... I'm very happy.
And with
that,
our podcast, yeah, too. It's just
our podcast. That is really weird.
Crazy little experiment.
Yeah, that is weird. But if you made it this far and you don't think it's worth 5 stars, or at least 4.5 stars, then I don't really know why you're still listening. What are you doing? What are you doing? So, yeah. All right. Rate, review, subscribe. That helps us boost our ratings and helps us keep doing this. Because if we're not getting good reviews and good ratings and more listeners all the time, then we'll probably go off and do something else. But we'd rather be doing this.
Yep.
So, yeah. Do it, do it, do it. All right, we'll see you on the next episode of The Dish for Tapas Part 3, the final installment. But is it tapas, or is it different small plate dishes? Don't know, we're going to find out. Thanks for listening to The Dish. Don't forget to subscribe and keep this podcast on the air by giving us a 5-star review on your preferred podcast app or channel.
Also, come join our foodie community on Facebook in the Food Worth Traveling For Facebook group. Catch you next time.